Hey, what's this shit?
Prepare for a Gopher football knowledge bomb. This is the FBT podcast with hosts MV.
Welcome back to the FBT podcast. This is your host, MB. I'm here with Frothy Gopher again. And from the sounds of things going around the internet these days, I'm pretty sure that our fan base wants to completely burn down everything. Just shut
fire, kill! Fire, kill!
Just fire, Jerry, kill. Not the name of the website. Burn down TCF Bank Stadium, replace it with a library or the East Corridor Gateway District. Biomedical buildings, just go University of Chicago style, completely shut everything down, let everybody else transfer. We are the new Penn State. Hey, we are.
I don't even know what to tell you, Matt. I know that from your tweets this week, you haven't really spent a lot of time looking at what's going on in the Gopher Inertrons, but I tweeted something yesterday that was something along the lines of the Gopher Inertrons at this point in time, and then it was just equals, and then a picture of Chernobyl, because that's really what it looks like right now. I don't even know what to say, and maybe part of it is going 4-0 was the worst thing that could have ever happened to us as fans.
No, that's a hyperbolic. That's just pure hyperbole.
Well, it's hyperbole. It's hyperbole, yeah, but it's true, because we came out of that 4-0, and we talked about it after, you know, going into the Iowa game, that, you know, we had some concerns, and that, you know, we were excited that we were 4-0, but if you looked at the Gopher Inertrons then, there were all sorts of talk about, you know, wow, you know, we can win at Iowa, and we can beat Northwestern, and we're going to be 6-0 going into that Wisconsin game. And wow, they look like crap. So maybe we'll be 7-0, and then we beat Purdue at home. God, all of a sudden, you know, we're 8-0 going into that Michigan game. And I like that. That's fun, right? It's been a rough couple of years for us here. And, you know, that was fun. And I get that. But if you look back at what we were expecting at the beginning of the season, and we can certainly go back and look at our podcast, and you can hold me to account here, but I'm reasonably sure that me and you and most of the people on the interwebs were saying something between 4 and 6 wins. Some people said 3, some people said 7, maybe an outside chance at 8 or 2. But by and large, the consensus was in that 4 to 6 wins. Well, we're sitting at 4 wins right now, and we still have a chance. As far as I know, the schedule still continues. We can still get to, you know, maybe 5 wins if we beat Purdue, maybe 6 wins if we beat Illinois, maybe we shock someone. So we're still well within the target of getting those 4 to 6 wins, and we've already achieved the lower end of that range. But to see what's going on, you know, in the media, but, you know, that's just sort of par for the course. It's a good storyline to talk about the Gophers imploding again. But our own fans have absolutely just turned against the team. And what I want you to talk about here a little bit is what is going on with the team that maybe has led to some of the performances. Iowa was a dumpster fire the first half. Northwestern, mistakes were made. We lost that game, even though we outplayed them for much of it. Wisconsin, thought we played pretty well for the first half, and the wheels kind of came off in the third and fourth quarter. But looking at what this team is comprised of right now, I have absolutely no idea how you can justify the ridiculously critical take on the coaches, on the players, on everything, the program itself. And before we're done here, I want to talk about canceling the UNC series, because that has gotten so much play and there is so much contempt toward Kill, toward Teague, toward the program as a whole, that I just don't get within the context of the college football universe. Can they be, you know, and before I'm done here, I just want to say I'm absolutely willing to criticize Kill. I'm willing to criticize the team. I'm willing to criticize Teague and the cancellation of the UNC series. But to the extent that this has been taken as the team has now imploded, there's no hope. Let's talk about maybe what happens after Kill, because it's clearly not going to work here. Recruiting is a dumpster fire. The players aren't playing. They're not executing. The game plan is terrible. We cancel the UNC series. He's scared. He's afraid he's not going to be able to get the team up, so we have to keep playing, you know, the school for the blind and deaf, right? And that's our only chance to win. Help me understand what is going on here, right? So maybe provide some context for us. You're the guy who knows everything about Gopher football. What's going on with the team, and what are maybe some of the reasons why the team has performed the way that they have over the last few games to hopefully shed some light to our friends who are now living in a land of hyperbole?
It's actually the answer to this is actually really simple. And if you don't want to burn the program down, and if you try and think about things in a rational perspective, which I know a lot of people don't often do because they're very passionate, and passionate people are generally can be a bit irrational. But let's think about things under these terms. Minnesota is now -9 in their last three games in turnover margin. We have not generated a single turnover after winning the turnover battle in every single game in the non-conference schedule, except for the Western Michigan game. We have only generated 2 sacks in the last three games after completely obliterating teams with our front four through the non-conference schedule. We are injured to all hell. When we walked into Madison, we were starting 4 backups from left tackle all the way through right tackle. The only opening day starter available to play and not injured is Josh Campion. And every other offensive lineman that is playing is an undersized, inexperienced, and in some cases, a walk-on.
How many walk-ons?
We are playing 3 walk-ons in the interior of our offensive line. John Christensen, who is a backup center, playing left guard.
Starting left guard,
and he is a redshirt freshman walk-on. Zach Matla. Well, I take back the statement that I said about we're starting. Not a single opening day starter is listed at the as starting on the offensive line. Matla was an opening day starter, but he is also a walk-on. He is undersized. And Zach Epping, who replaced him in about the third week, and who I think was actually better than him, injured his hand and he can't snap the ball anymore. And then we have Caleb Bach, who I think is a fairly decent guard, but he's also a redshirt sophomore walk-on. So when you're playing very young, very inexperienced linemen in the trenches, that's the most critical position on the field other than quarterback, and guess what we're starting there? We are starting either a true sophomore or a true freshman because Marquise Gray is hurt. And it's no coincidence that the offense started to implode when everybody all of our important players along the offensive line at quarterback started to get injured. And it's just spread throughout the entire offense. Frickty is concussed. Devin Crawford Tufts is concussed. All these guys are just getting banged up all over the place. Kirkwood is wearing down. It's so difficult in college football to maintain any sort of consistency on offense and to have a consistent offense, especially for a ball control possession type offense that Minnesota runs, without having continuity along the offensive line and at quarterback. And we have had neither the last 4 games or so. We beat Syracuse because the defense played out of their minds and Max didn't make any mistakes. But look what happened when we went to Iowa. We made a bunch of mistakes. We played like crap. Offense couldn't score, couldn't move the ball at all in the first half. We were down 24 points already. Northwestern, we turned the ball over on the opening kickoff, down 7 points, immediate negativity. another turnover leads to another touchdown, down 21-7, and we're already behind the eight ball. Madison, we keep these guys close until Philip Nelson throws an interception, and then the floodgates start to open in the third quarter. I'm telling people, Gopher fans who are listening to this, you have to understand that it is incredibly difficult to win anywhere, when you turn the ball over as much as we've been turning the ball over in the last 3 weeks. And when you were not generating turnovers ourselves, we're not generating pressure on the quarterback as much because the offensive lines we're playing have been much better. But then you also add in this component. We've played some very good teams and on the road. If we had played Iowa at home for a third consecutive year, very good chance we actually win that game. Because Iowa is playing absolutely abysmal right now. And I don't think that they would be able to get up to play the Gophers in TCF Bank Stadium again. If we played Wisconsin at home, perhaps the game would have been closer. Northwestern is a very good team this year. Give credit to the smart kids when they're not working on their jetpacks, and inventing the new neutron nuke or whatever the hell they do at the down in Evanston. They have a good team. You can't turn the ball over to good teams like Northwestern that have some players and expect to win the game, especially when you're just banged up and have no continuity on offense. So to the extent that given all of those factors, I don't get why people have just jettisoned the Gopher bandwagon so quickly. Is it just one of these things that's the mentality of a Gopher fan that the second trouble arises, the second that first loss happens, then everybody just jumps off and says, oh, same old Gophers. I find that mentality to be ridiculous because, as you said, the expectations of this team going into this year were 4-6 wins. If everything goes right, this team could contend for a bowl. This team had talent, but it needed to stay healthy. They needed to keep Gray healthy because if Gray went down and if the offensive and key components of the team were injured and couldn't stay healthy, we were in for some trouble. Well, guess what's happened? Marquise Gray is hurt. Some key components all over the place are hurt and not available to the team right now. We're just trying to get healthy, and look at where we are. We're at 4 wins. We're on the precipice of the most important game of the season against a team similarly just fighting for its life. And this is the position you're in when you don't have depth and you don't have a margin for error. I know it's cliche. I know Kill has talked about how young the team is. But it is young. It's young at quarterback. It's young at offensive line. It's young at defensive line, except for Optimus Prime and D.L. Wilhite and Roland Johnson. But he's a JUCO transfer. He's playing in only his seventh game, and he's injured. Another guy who's injured. So to all of this extent, we're young. We're banged up. We don't have depth. And when you add all of those factors into it, along with a team that has a really poor recent history, not a whole lot of success that it can fall back on, especially for the current seniors. Some of these guys have been through really crappy seasons and haven't had a whole lot of success. It becomes difficult to reverse all of this momentum when you don't have the built-in advantages of other teams.
Well, yeah, that was good, and thanks for that. I had a good exchange with someone on Twitter this weekend after the Wisconsin game who said something to the extent of, I guess, you know, we're going to hear from Coach Kill the youth excuse again. I'm sick and tired of hearing about it. And to the point you just made, we are an unbelievably young team. So I get that people get frustrated if hearing the youth excuse and they feel like they hear the youth excuse every year. But when it's true, it's true. You can't expect true freshmen, redshirt freshmen, sophomores, redshirt sophomores to come in and compete with teams that have significantly older depth. And that's, I guess, the second thing that I'd like to hear about, right, is we have all this youth along the offensive line. We have all this youth at wide receiver. We have all this youth, particularly at safety. why is that? Why don't we have any older, experienced offensive lines, offensive linemen coming through? Why are we starting, you know, Josh Campion, a redshirt freshman? Why are we starting, you know, Tommy Olsen, a true sophomore? Why are we starting these guys when, if you look at the more successful teams in the Big Ten, they have older, more experienced offensive linemen? Because the point I think we've made a number of times here, it's a big, big difference when you've got a 22 or 23-year-old offensive lineman who has spent 5 years in the weight room, is well-conditioned, has good bend, than going up against a 19, 20, or 21-year-old offensive lineman who maybe hasn't had a significant amount of time. You know, Tommy Olsen's a beast, but Tommy Olsen is, you know, he's only a year and a half out of high school. And Tommy Olsen has only had, you know, a year, year and a half in the weight program. So as much of a beast as he is, how much of a bigger beast is he going to be 2 years from now when he's a senior? And those are the kinds of guys, though they may not have the innate ability that Tommy Olsen does, you know, they've had an additional 2 years in their strength and conditioning program so that they're starting as redshirt juniors and really getting run in the last 2 years that, you know, they have eligibility. So I guess what I'd like to understand is, you know, I think it's fine to be critical of the fact that our offense is unable to move the ball, that we use very vanilla conservative play calling. I think that is an absolutely justifiable criticism that was with Lime Grover when he was at Northern Illinois. But we have a very young offensive line, and you know, that's my old position. I know that if your offensive line doesn't understand more complex maneuvers, that you always fall back on the real basic sort of power formation. And that's what we run, at least from my eyes, about 9 times out of 10. So why don't we have a more experienced offensive line? Why don't we have an older offensive line? Help us understand maybe some of those reasons as to why we don't have what is available to most other Big Ten teams.
Well, glad you asked this question. Glad you want to know. It all stems back to that 2008 Time Brewster recruiting class. The one that was much ballyhooed, ranked 17th in the nation, had awesome studs in it like Marquise Gray, Keenan Cooper, Sam Mayer, Spencer Reeves, Juwan Edwards. List goes on and on of all the four stars that Brewster brought in with that class. You want to know what he didn't bring in with that class? He did not bring in a single prep offensive lineman. Not one. He did get Matt Carriefeld, the transfer from Notre Dame, but that's essentially like taking a JUCO. So at a position where it is absolutely critical, as you said, to develop these guys over time, redshirt them, get them in the weight room, get them understanding how to teach them zone blocking techniques and other types of skills that take longer to learn because, as I talked about in the podcast for 2 years now with Derek Burns, former Gopher captain and offensive lineman, that understanding who to block in a zone blocking scheme is by far the first thing that needs to happen, and it is the most critical. Because if you don't know where and who you're supposed to block, everything else isn't going to matter whatsoever. So we're only a year and a half in to learning this new offensive line system, and it would have been great if we had guys that had 4 years of understanding zone blocking techniques, and then they were fifth-year seniors, so that we can install those guys in the line versus having to play a redshirt freshman like John Christensen at left guard. If we could have redshirted Tommy Olsen last year instead of having to play him as a true freshman. If we could play experienced upperclassmen who had gone through the program and had developed, this is the one position where it would absolutely pay the biggest dividends. And unfortunately, we don't have it. And even worse, that 2009 recruiting class, which had more offensive linemen, one of them was a junior college transfer in Jeff Wills. Another one was Eddie Olsen. Another one was Josh Campion, who ended up sitting out a year, then going to Fork Union. So he is essentially a wash. And then the other is Brooks Michael, who, God bless the kid, ended up with concussions and then is no longer part of the program. He can't play. You go back to, you go down to 2010 class. Jimmy Jerry, arguably the most talented offensive lineman that we have in the program. Just a physical beast. Has future NFL player all written all over him. Concussion problems. Career is over. Guy like Matt Egan leaves the program. Sean Ferguson leaves the program. We just have so many players that have not yet developed in 3 years of recruiting that is really, really showing and manifesting itself along the offensive line right now. It's just not, it is not a position where you can afford to not recruit players and develop them every single year. And fortunately for us, the current staff understands this. They understand you have to sign offensive linemen, whether they and bring them into the program every single year, whether or not they're scholarship linemen or they're local walk-ons that you can convince, local players that you can convince to walk on that may develop into really good players and that are going to serve as adequate depth down the road. That who knows, they could be a player like a, you know, maybe a Robert Gallery down the road. I'm just throwing names out of guys who were former walk-ons that ended up being awesome Big Ten players, because you never know what happened, how a guy's body will just explode in a Big Ten weight program. Ricky Wagner at Wisconsin is an example of another guy that's done it. So when you don't put an emphasis on recruiting offensive linemen and you recruit skill position players because they're the easiest ones to get in and get convince them to play early because they can play earlier, you set yourself up in a trap. So it's essentially you are mortgaging your future to attract better skill position players in the present and hope that they can, that they are explosive enough to be able to put your team over the hump. And as we have found out, this strategy failed absolutely miserably.
Okay, that's good. That's helpful. And while I'm sure it won't assuage everyone that Brewster's to blame, right, I think there's a certain element of truth to it, that you cannot, you absolutely cannot ignore the offensive line. Because if there's one thing that we've seen from our hated rivals to the East and the South, you get your offensive linemen at home or in around the area. And that's what we're going to produce more than any other skill position, any of the skill positions. We're going to produce offensive linemen, to a lesser extent defensive linemen. But yeah, you see the hated neighbors to the East and South, and a lot of those offensive linemen are homegrown right in their own state. So good. I think that's useful. The second of the three things that I want to get to on this podcast is better dead than redshirt. We've burned all the redshirts. Now what I've seen again in the Gophertrons and the infinite wisdom shown there is that this is a sign that, that Kill is panicking a little bit. You take off Phil Nelson's, the sweet Philly dog, the Mankato Jesus. You take off his red shirt, it's a sign of panic. You take off Nugget, Roderick Williams' red shirt, sign of panic. Lincoln Pilsack, same thing, sign of panic. We've now burned, I think, on the order of something like 10 red shirts this year. Is it a sign of panic? I look at that and say, absolutely hell no, it's not a sign of panic. You know, back when, you know, we look back on the Brewster era, and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Brewster and Kill, etc. To me, it's all water under the bridge. But we were begging to see Marquise Gray come in at quarterback when we felt like the season was starting to turn the wrong way. And Brewster never put him in. We never got a chance to see him. Well, now our starting quarterback and unquestioned leader of the team, Marquise Gray, is hurt. In all likelihood, is not really going to be 100% to play quarterback the rest of the year. We gave Shortell a run out there. He got some head injury issues. Quite frankly, didn't look all that great out there in the time that he was out there. But, you know, again, true sophomore. But he wasn't really looking the part, had some injury issues. So what do? We bring out Phil Nelson to give him a chance, to get him some run, to see what he's got, to set us up better for the future. So this isn't a sign of panic in my mind. This is a sign of we've had some injury issues. Would it be better to redshirt him? Yeah, probably. But seeing that Gray is not going to be able to play quarterback for the rest of the year, seeing that we need to understand what we've got at the quarterback position going into next year, why not get Phil Nelson out there and see what he can do? And quite frankly, I think he played his heart out in what must have been a ridiculously stressful situation and put up some pretty good numbers. You didn't knock anyone's socks off, but for a first ever start at Camp Randall Stadium where they never lose against, you know, the team that he probably grew up a fan of, I thought he played pretty damn well. So what do you think? Is Kill panicking here? Is this desperation? Are we in year one and a half of the Kill era on the 7-year contract and he's already just setting fire to everything trying to win now, or is this part of a longer term plan?
So the question I have, the rhetorical question that I want to ask in people who feel that Kill is panicking right now by pulling the red shirt off of Phillip Nelson, is it fair to the seniors of this team who are now 4-0, who've just gone through two straight three win seasons back to back? They have just gotten their brains bashed in by a lot of teams. They've had a lot of heartbreak. They've only been to two bowls. They've had their coach fired. They've had a new guy come in. Do you really want to have those seniors? Do you really want to sacrifice their final year, their final shot at a bowl and at something that they can look back on and say, hey, you know, we went through some struggles as a team, but, you know, my senior year, we ended up turning it around a little bit. I helped become part of the change to get the program moved around, and we went to a bowl. Are we going to rob people? Are we going to rob the seniors of that opportunity just so we can preserve Phillip Nelson's red shirt when he may give the team the best chance to win at quarterback? Because, as you said, every other option is injured. I guess I don't understand the logic of that. I really don't. I have a hard time putting my brain around that. To me, Kill's choice was made for him. Max wasn't playing well, and he was injured. Gray, if he was completely healthy, he'd be the guy starting because he gives the team the best option. So where's the controversy? Nelson is the best guy right now. And you know what? If Gray ever does come back healthy, he gets a couple snaps in there. Maybe they play two quarterbacks with him and play with him and Nelson. Maybe they play with him and Shortell. But I guess I just don't see why this is a sign of panic to pull the red shirt off of Nelson. And the same thing with all the other freshmen. If pulling their red shirt now, and if they can contribute even for a handful of plays a game, that is going to help us win a game this season, wouldn't you take that? Wouldn't you take the chance to get to 6 wins and maybe sacrifice a couple red shirts in the beginning of the Kill era under the assumption that down the road that we're going to get better players because our record is going to be better? I guess I don't understand that mentality either. It's as if, no, we're only ever going to get the type of players that we're going to get now. So in order for us to ever get better, we need to redshirt and develop as many players as possible. Well, there's a catch-22 of that. If you continuously redshirt, you're always going to be in this position where you're going to have less than ideal seasons. So the time to have done that was last year. If we were going to do that, we should have redshirted absolutely everybody last year, not played Marcus Jones, not played Derek Wells, not played Cedric Thompson, not played Michael Emefiele, not played Tommy Olsen, not played Max Shortell. We should have redshirted each and every one of those guys and just done a total mulligan year in 2011 so that 2012 we would have these guys developed and that by the time they're fifth-year seniors that they would be awesome. But you know what? College coaches don't have that luxury. To a certain extent, even with a 7-year contract, they have to win now. And no, it is not a sign of panic. You win games now. The onus on the coach is to win as many games in the season as possible. And especially for this team, they need that 6 wins. They need that bowl preparation. They need something to look forward to. They need to get something to build around and be excited. So, again, don't understand the controversy. Don't understand why people are so bent out of shape and think that that burning all these red shirts is a huge deal. In fact, I found myself unbelievably agreeing with almost the entire cacophony of the drive time media with this topic, and every single one of them saying, yeah, go ahead and pull these red shirts. So, I mean, I guess I'm part of the media jackal cabal now, where I just don't get it. Yeah, in an ideal situation, you redshirt everybody, but we don't have that luxury. We don't have the luxury.
I see what happens. You go on KFan a few times, and now all of a sudden you're one of the media jackals.
I'm one of them now, yeah. But
I tell you what, brother, I'm never headed down that road. You can only listen to me on the internet. I won't become like you.
It's probably a good thing.
So the last thing that I want to get to, and it's also been a hot sprots take of the media jackal, so hopefully you're not in agreement here, and that is with regard to canceling the UNC series. So a couple of weeks ago, or I think it was last week sometime, word came out that Coach Kill, and Teague was really pretty clear about this, Coach Kill decided that we didn't want to play UNC. I think it was a home and home with them, and I think it was 2013 and 2015, if I recall correctly. And word came out that we had backed out of that series and that we had replaced them with New Mexico State, so a little bit of vengeance for getting beat by them last year, I think is hopefully part of the plan. But not only did we cancel the series with UNC, we also had to fork over something in the neighborhood of $800,000 for the privilege of canceling the series. And oh, hell, that caused so much controversy that's still going on right now. Oh, Coach Kill is scared. We got to continue to play cream puffs. The only way, you know, the only way that we can ever get to a bowl is scheduling a, you know, a Mason-esque non-conference schedule. And what does this say about Kill's confidence in his players that we can't possibly take on UNC, et cetera, who's not even really a very good team? And I look at it and say it's disappointing. A, because I think going out to Chapel Hill would be a hell of a fun trip for fans. I was thinking about maybe heading out there myself. B, it is more interesting to watch us play against BCS competition. But I also know enough to, you know, maybe open up some other news sources and get a little sense about whether this happens across the college football landscape. And yeah, you know, over the last couple of weeks, and this is the, you know, maybe the timing wasn't perfect here, but over the last couple of weeks, you see Wisconsin trying to get a series set up with Alabama. You see Ohio State scheduling a game against Oregon, I think in 2020 and 2021. So you are seeing a little bit of this, but you know, this is the part that it's like a bullet to my heart. We are not Wisconsin or Ohio State right now, right? We're just in a different place. So while I get the frustration and on some level I'm pretty disappointed that Kill did it, if you look across the college football landscape, you'll see that this is not unusual at all. And I think based on where we are as a program, I think Kill's absolutely right. The wins and the bowl practice are more important to us right now than playing against North Carolina. And even if we beat North Carolina, it doesn't give us enough cachet to really make up for the risks of losing to North Carolina and potentially missing out on a bowl game. And for those who say that maybe our best game last year was our loss against USC, I say in all likelihood that was probably a fluke. And if we can't expect to get lightning in a bottle, and that 9 times out of 10, if we play USC, if we play Texas, we're going to get our asses handed to us in all likelihood on national TV, and that's not going to do very much for recruiting either. I think that he's taken a smart, sensible approach that, while very, very disappointing as a fan, is probably the right approach to take. So what do you think? What's the landscape look like across college football? Is this part of the norm? Is it completely and totally unusual and everyone is right to be pissed off at Kill? Help me understand where we come down on that.
Well, I said from the beginning that this is not the UNC scheduling kerfuffle is not a controversy at all. The people are making far too big a deal about this than they really need to. So first things first, Kill wanted this series canceled from the moment he arrived on campus. When he got hired, he looked at this team schedule in 2013, ran to Joel Maturi and said, I don't want to play North Carolina in North Carolina. I want this series canceled. I know from beating this team in the last season and beating them pretty soundly with a MAC team that there's a lot of work to do around here. We need to go into total program building mode here. So Joel, even though it was his swan song, could just as easily have started to work and cancel that series then. But we know how Joel works, and he drags his feet on everything, and everything is always such a laborious process with him. It's just pulling teeth to get Mercury to do anything that might be having the slightest bit of negativity with the media and the fans. So, obviously, it doesn't happen. But shouldn't your head coach have a say in your schedule? And shouldn't your athletic director be behind the coach's decision? And furthermore, shouldn't the president be behind the coach's decision and the athletic director's decision? This is like a Mayan positioning of planets here. You know, I feel like planet X is going to come down and smash into Earth into 1,000 tiny pieces because we finally have a coach, athletic director, and president who are all on the same page and just want what's best for the program and that's going to do everything to be accommodative. What has this ever happened in this school? It's never happened. So when we finally happen, the first chance that we get to really show that the administration and the athletic director are really behind Kill and what his plan is, oh, what do? We complain that he doesn't want to play North Carolina. Well, that's his prerogative, you know? It's okay that fans don't like that we're not playing North Carolina, but the coach has his reasons. And it's not this stupid, esoteric reasons like, oh, he's afraid we're not going to beat North Carolina. What kind of message does it send that to his players that they can't beat North Carolina? Well, North Carolina is a damn good team. They've had like 20 NFL draft picks in the last 5 years. They're extraordinarily talented. And as you said, the risks of playing a team like North Carolina right now, so the risks of losing to them and losing pretty big, are infinitely more damaging to the program in its chance to claw back to respectability than it would be to actually beat them. I don't think you're going to get a huge marginal lift by beating North Carolina in the non-conference schedule any more than you would beating, say, a Nebraska or a Michigan State. And I would argue, and I've argued this countless times, that beating teams in the Big Ten and the Big Ten schedule is all that matters. And Kill gets it. He has said about this topic numerous times. It's about the Big Ten, and it's about big picture. He's not talking about, oh, just getting us back to a bowl. He's about reversing 45 years of misery in this town. And in order to actually change, turn around that misery and achieve the ultimate goal of getting to the Rose Bowl, they need to win Big Ten games. So if you're of the philosophy that playing teams that are above your level in non-conference prepares you for the Big Ten schedule, then that's fine. It's a perfectly acceptable argument to have. But this coach has a different philosophy. And by the way, he has mentioned that after the program has gotten to a point in which they are elevated, then he starts ramping up the schedule and scheduling more challenging opponents in non-conference play. But now, it's not worth the effort that it's been given and the amount of angst that it's generated out of the Gopher fan base and the Sprotts takes out of the local media. And quite frankly, it shows how little this town watches college football and pays attention because this happens all the time. Series get canceled and moved and buyouts get paid all the time. It happens every single year. I mean, literally the day, like days after we announced this, the UNC schedule was canceled, Vanderbilt comes out and cancels both North Carolina and Ohio State for next year. Were Vanderbilt fans up in arms about not playing two Big Ten teams in the same year? No, I doubt it. And you want to know what? James Franklin is getting the same type of accommodative scheduling power with over who he plays in the non-conference schedule that Kill is getting. And this is seen as a good thing that Vanderbilt is going to be more conducive to what James Franklin wants. And we should be applauding Norwood Teague and Eric Kaler that they're actually willing to listen and willing to work with Kill and do these sorts of things. Not say, oh, well, Teague should have just kept it. Teague should have kept the series and told Kill no, should have refused him. Well, no is what Joel Mercury did. Why would we ever want to go back to what Joel Mercury did?
So, as we kind of wrap this up, I'm going to toss away all the good work that we've done here over the last 35, 40 minutes or so, and I'm going to go ahead and get you an explicit rating on iTunes. So I just want to say this because I think you said something in that last segment that really is worth paying attention to as we look at what's happening within the Gopher program right now. You said that there has been about 45 years of misery for this program, and with very few exceptions over the last 45 years, that's been the case. Yeah, I've been a fan of the Gophers my entire life, and the number of sad, depressing times are far, far outweigh the moments of glory. So when you look at the grand scope of kind of where the program is at, and it's disappointing to lose to Iowa, and it's disappointing to lose to Wisconsin, and I get really, really fucking upset. I mean, I'm despondent for days afterward. But we've been really a terrible program for decades. And I got excited when we were 4-0, and it's disappointing right now to be 4-3, considering the three losses, two of them against our most bitter rivals and one of them against a team that, quite frankly, we outplayed. But at the end of the day, this is going to take time. And yeah, it sucks to be 4-0 and now to be 4-3 and potentially be looking at a not great conference record by the time all is said and done, but fucking relax. Seriously. Go for Intertrons. Relax.
So I'm going to actually make a long-form post about this or article later on this week. But I saw a billboard sign driving down France Avenue last Friday before I was going to the movies and out to dinner in the movies on date night with the future wifey. And the sign said, "Impatience never commanded success." And this came right on the heels of the Philip Nelson news. And I was thinking to myself, okay, is this a sign from the gods that maybe we shouldn't be playing Philip Nelson, that Kill should just take his lumps this year, play Max even though he's hurt, maybe even, you know, suit up Dexter Foreman against Wisconsin if need be. But then I got to thinking about it even more. And what I realized was the fan base needs to be the patient ones. We can't be impatient about commanding and demanding success out of this team because we historically have not had it. And quite frankly, we don't really have the gall to tell a coach in year 1.5 of a program that has just lost countless amount of games. I mean, the bookends of the Brewster era were some of the most miserable moments in the last 45 years of Gopher football. So given where we are coming off, it's the lowest of the lows of 2007, and essentially a dead cat bounce for the next 2 years, and then slumping down again in 2010. We do not have the right as fans to demand that a coach come in and turn around a program in 1.5 years and get them to the level which we are competing and beating Iowa and Wisconsin in their homes when they have had countless more winning seasons and great seasons over the last 4 decades than we have. I simply cannot fathom where some people get off to say, I can no longer be patient with this team. You know what? You're going to have to. Because unless you want to turn into a Cubs fan, where every single year becomes, well, better luck next year, then you have to sort of take things for what they're worth. This is a team that's rebuilding. Kill came in here, initially got a 5-year contract, took a look around and said, no, I don't want just a 5-year contract. This is going to take a lot longer. I want a 7-year contract. Kill has no pressure. He has that 7-year contract. He doesn't have to go and recruit JUCO players a la Bill Snyder and reload that way. He doesn't have to take shortcuts in order to build the type of program he wants. He can get the program to where it needs to be, and quite frankly, it's closer to where it was the program is closer to the where Southern Illinois was when Kill took over that program than it was with Northern Illinois. People don't like to hear it, but like Randy Moss says, the truth hurts. People don't like it, but the truth hurts. So please, fans, be patient. Success is only going to come for those who understand that this is a process. You can't just demand wins. You have to demand that the whole organization change and that you're putting in your process. Because if your process is right, you will see results. And quite frankly, given this staff's history, they have a track record of a good process in place and a process that frankly wins when they're there. But once they leave and move on, the people that take over for them also have success. And I think it has a lot to do with changing culture and improving the process of those particular programs. And I'm done.
Yeah, so we just did our bit to stand against the tide of Gopher angst. I guess the question you have to ask yourself is, if you want Kill gone, first of all, Kill's not going anywhere for years, right? So disabuse yourself of the notion that he's going to go somewhere. Second of all, don't assume that because we take this attitude of let's wait and see, that somehow we're not pissed about losing. I'm pissed about losing. I hate losing. I hate having a team that does this to me every single year.
You know who is equally pissed off at losing?
Who?
Jerry Kill.
Absolutely.
So I guess fans are the only ones who get to be indignant about a loss. Kill can't be just as pissed off, and the players can't be just as pissed off about losing to their bitter rivals. Only the fans get that opportunity.
But for those of you who want to fire Kill, ask yourself this question. You've got someone to Kill's resume who's been successful everywhere he's gone. Everywhere he's been, he has turned a program into a winning program. You want to get rid of him, let's say after 3 years, let's say maybe after 4 years, who the hell are you going to get to come here? That guy is as respected as they come within the entire coaching industry, right? And again, he's been successful everywhere he's come. Unless you're going to fork out $5 million a year, who are you going to get? And I know that's kind of a defeatist approach to take, but it's the truth. So we've got a new AD, we've got a new president, we got a new coach, still only, 19 games in right now. Why don't we give this a chance to work a little bit before we start talking about cleaning house? The Kill is somehow panicking. He's coached 200 games in his career. You think he's going to be panicking right now? Is that really, really what you think? Or are you just taking some hot Sprotts takes out to the Intertrons to see how it flies? Fucking relax.
Couldn't have said it better myself. All right, folks, that concludes it for this FBT podcast. Join us back next week when we either praise Kill again and talk about how everything is great in the world now that we have beaten the specter known as Purdue football, or we are going into a cutting spree and pouring bleach down our throats because the whole world is ending, everything is collapsing, and we just want to die.